I'm reading from Matthew 27, verses 15 to 31. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And all the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." Then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him. I often do a Christmas series, but I've never had the opportunity to do an Easter series. Usually it's just a single Easter message that I use. Some of that is just a scheduling issue. Most years we take our trip to serve with Tapestries of Life in Mexico the week leading up to Easter, and I usually miss the Sunday before Easter because of that. But this year, because of where Easter falls, we are actually not leaving for that trip until after the Easter holiday. So I have this stretch of 3 Sundays leading up to Easter before I'll be gone for a week. So what I'd like to do is just a short Easter series reflecting on this central component of our faith, Jesus offering his life for sin and then rising from the dead 3 days later. And to do that, I'd like to consider 3 deep ironies in the Passion of Christ recorded for us by Matthew. We'll start today with the announcement of Jesus as the King of the Jews. When God raised up David as an idyllic leader of the nation after the failed kingship of Saul, he promised that David's house and David's kingdom would be permanently established. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 16. A sure kingdom, an eternal throne. For many generations, this seemed to be working out on some level. And even after civil war split the nation, the southern kingdom of Judah, who remained faithful to the Davidic line and established their kingdom around the divinely chosen capital city of Jerusalem, had an unbroken line of kings descended from David throughout its history. The northern kingdom of Israel, by contrast, had a stuttering mix of dynastic families that were always susceptible to usurpation. But despite this unbroken bloodline in the southern royal lineage, there was not a corresponding steadiness in faithfulness. So they were genetically Davidic, but they were not spiritually Davidic, not men after God's own heart, as David had been described in 1 Samuel chapter 13. In fact, this passage where David is described as a man after God's own heart is a passage where Samuel the prophet is explaining why God is not going to establish Saul's kingdom forever. It's because Saul had not kept the Lord's commands. But many descendants of David who are sitting on the throne are, by and large, a lot more like Saul, spiritually speaking, than David. And there was this growing expectation among the faithful that a true descendant of David, with wholehearted devotion to God, would arise and lead the nation toward faithfulness. It was not enough to have the physical lineage. They knew they needed someone to take the reins spiritually and be the leader who would revive the nation. David was not that king. He ended up having his own major moral failure. Nor was his son Solomon, nor any descendant after that in the line of succession that occupied the throne of Judah. 250 years in, and they're still waiting to see this promise fulfilled. When Isaiah rises up to prophesy to the nation, the Davidic rulership was falling far short of the imagined ideals. Uzziah and Jotham, two kings who reigned during Isaiah's prophetic ministry, were both reasonably good leaders, but they failed to remove the idolatrous high places, thereby allowing the nation to just slide deeper into idolatry. But Ahaz, one of the kings that Isaiah prophesied during, is so bad that he's described as being like the apostate kings of Israel. Listen to this grim summary from 2 Kings chapter 16, verse 2 through 3. Ahaz did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. That's about as bad a description as a king will get, that they even sacrificed their sons to foreign gods. And this is probably the leader in focus when Isaiah unleashes his prophetic ire against the nation in the opening lines of his book. Isaiah comes out of the gate hot, pointing out how their loyalty is susceptible to brides, and they could care less about the fatherless and the widow, in Isaiah 1, verse 23. He describes it as their silver becoming like dross, their best wine mixed with water, chapter 1, verse 22. These are just poetic descriptions of this corruption. Their identity as the chosen people of God has been utterly defiled. They've taken their pure calling and polluted it. But Isaiah has hope. The long-anticipated promised Davidic king was not just an illusion. He believes that God will refine them through this process, smelt away that dross, remove the impurities, chapter 1, verse 25, and then restore their rulers and reestablish Jerusalem as a city of righteousness and faithfulness, in chapter 1, verse 26. This all sounds really promising. And the reach of this kingdom will extend further than just ethnic Israel. Isaiah imagines a time in chapter 2 when the rulership of Israel will judge between the nations and decide disputes between many.